Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Constitution according to the Tea Party, the Constitution according to you. As Congress resumes work today after its break following the Arizona shooting, it's with the new requirement to attach an explicit constitutional rationale for any new bill. It's a Tea Party initiative to highlight how little the Constitution allows Washington to do. But how little does it? We'll have a debate now with two constitutional scholars. We'll focus on the Tea Party's favorite passages of the Constitution and how both sides claim the Constitution is on their side as they prepare to re-debate health care regulation. And we will hear from some of you. We've been asking for your favorite passages on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Here to tackle your submissions and what's going on in Congress today are two scholars from relatively right and left. Ilya Shapiro, a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute. He's also editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Ilya, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Nate Persily, the Charles Keller Beekman Professor of Law and Political Science at Columbia Law School. Professor Persily, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Do you see this new requirement to have a constitutional authority statement, that's what they're calling it, a constitutional authority statement attached to any new bill as a symbolic gesture, or can you get specific, Ilya, about how it will change legislation in the 112th Congress?
Well, the devil, of course, will be in the details of what they do when they legislate and whether they'll just be paying lip service to it or whether they'll actually be debating the constitutionality and so forth. But I think it's certainly a good symbolic step, and we'll see, you know, if it even gets half a dozen or a dozen members of Congress to think twice before voting for something because of constitutional doubts, I think we'll have moved the ball.
Nate?
I think it's great. The more attention paid to the Constitution, the better. And I think it is mainly a symbolic move, but it's always nice for congressmen to think about whether what they're doing is unconstitutional or not.
Now, the two of you have agreed to field some listener favorites in a little bit to see how much agreement or disagreement there is from right and left on some aspects of the Constitution that people are thinking about. But let's dive right in. Now, with our own favorite, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, better known as the Commerce Clause, quote, Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So, Ilya Shapiro, Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states, and I guess the question of the moment is, how does that relate to the current health care law?
Sure. Well, it depends on whether you're asking what that provision meant when it was ratified, or how it's come to be meant, given over 200 and especially the last 70 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence. The current standard is that Congress can regulate channels of interstate commerce, instrumentalities, meaning things and people in interstate commerce, and local activities that have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And of course, it's that third prong that's at issue with Obamacare, and especially the individual mandate, the requirement that everybody buy a health insurance policy. I've filed briefs, supporting the side, the states, and others who are challenging the constitutionality of the individual mandate and other provisions. Most importantly, because for the first time ever, this would be a requirement that somebody actually engage in economic activity rather than be prohibited from doing it or be told if they're already engaged in it, how they are to engage in it.
And listeners, we have a thoroughly unscientific constitutional poll question on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. You don't have to be a Supreme Court justice to have an opinion. Do you think it's constitutional for the federal government to require individuals to buy health insurance? Answer yes or no at itsafreecountry.org. And if you want to expand on your answer, join the conversation at itsafreecountry.org. Do you think it's constitutional for the federal government to require individuals to buy health insurance. And Nate Priscilli from the Columbia University Law School, is it really all about the use of the word among in the constitutional in the Commerce Clause, that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states as opposed to within the states?
No. I mean, I think that the argument with respect to health, the health care bill, is whether forcing someone to buy something is a regulation of interstate commerce. I mean, no one doubts that health care can be economic in nature. I mean, 1/6 of the U.S. economy is tied up in health care costs, et cetera. And indeed, so much of the debate over the health care bill now is about how much it's going to cost, how much it might increase the deficit or lower the deficit. And so it has a hook to commerce. Everyone realizes that in interstate commerce, after all, because of the huge effect that health care has in the country. The novel argument that Ilya was mentioning is, well, does the Interstate Commerce Clause allow you to force someone to buy something? And so the court, we have a district judge who's basically sided with the argument that, no, you can't regulate inactivity. But that argument has nothing to do with really among this. I mean, mm-hmm. You can spin
okay.
it out.
Right.
But it's really about the activity.
Is there a direct precedent, in your opinion?
A direct precedent for the health care bill or for...
Yeah, for the individual mandate in particular.
Well, there are very few things to the plaintiff's credit in this that government forces you to do. They force you to participate in the draft. They force you to fill out a census form, maybe to participate in a jury. But the argument in favor of this is that, look, whether you think it's unprecedented or not, that the problems people believe that we're confronting with the healthcare problems are unprecedented, and they are certainly commercial in effect, and so therefore it's square within Congress's ability to regulate interstate commerce to force people to participate. And more importantly, I mean, one of the arguments is that, look, people are going to end up paying for someone else's health insurance anyway, because they're going to end up going to emergency rooms, and we all have to pay for it either with taxes or increased premiums.
And listeners, what articles of the Constitution or amendments to the Constitution would you like to hear or two competing constitutional scholars discuss? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Remember a few weeks ago when we did a very short version of this, when that was all the time we had and we said we would stretch it out and do it longer? Well, this is it, and we have some time. So 212-433-9692 for Nate Priscilli from the Columbia University School of Law and Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. And Ilya, just one more thing on the individual mandate before we go on to some other issues. Here is one possible precedent that people have been bringing up. It's Wickard versus Filburn, 1942, in which the Supreme Court held that a farmer who grew wheat just for the consumption of his own family violated federal agricultural guidelines enacted pursuant to the Commerce Clause. Though the wheat did not move across state lines, indeed it never left his farm, the court held that if other similarly situated farmers were permitted to do the same, it might have an aggregate effect on interstate commerce. So does it all come down to whether we see seeing a doctor as an individual decision or a commercial one?
Partially. It's not about whether the decision is economic or commercial or not. It's about whether there's activity involved. That's the way that my side has been framing this, and Nate will disagree with that, obviously, for the reasons that he already said. But Wicker versus Filburn does represent the outermost bounds of Supreme Court precedent in this area. The difference is that even in the height of the New Deal, which this was, the regulation was existing farmers have to meet their quotas and bring that crop to market rather than consuming it at home for the reasons that you stated, the aggregate effect, et cetera. But nobody had to become a farmer, and nobody had to buy wheat, say, to prop up crop prices or what have you. So I think that the individual mandate is a step farther. And moreover, studies show that health care outcomes and taxpayer spending on health care as well are driven more by diet and exercise than by ownership of health insurance policies. So if anything, there's greater warrant to require people to join gyms or buy healthy foods than to buy a health insurance policy, which
that's irrelevant to the constitutional question, right? So, but let me follow up on an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by a colleague of yours, Roger Pilon from the Cato Institute, who highlighted the way in which he thinks the Supreme Court has actually eviscerated the Constitution back in the 1930s. He sees it as having turned the document from a list of specific enumerated powers, in other words, these are the only things the government may do, to a free pass to redistribute and regulate at will. Is that the time period that you'd point to as well as having changed constitutional interpretation? And are you angry at the Supreme Court for that?
Yeah, that is the starting point. Some decisions in 36, 37, 38, and continuing through the 40s, and then up through the modern time as well. But yeah, Wickard is in there, and a few other cases where now, for example, you know, clauses like, you know, getting back to the constitutional authority statements, you know, 90% of these will probably just tick the box Commerce Clause or Necessary and Proper Clause or General Welfare Clause, and these are misunderstood. For example, General Welfare Clause doesn't mean that Congress can just tax and spend for whatever it thinks is good, the only check being, you know, political, can it get the votes for it? The General Welfare Clause was actually a limitation. That is, the 18 enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 have to be exercised only in the general as opposed to the local or particular interest. Now, that is one example, and the other clauses have also been read very broadly, such that, you know, we're arguing at this extreme with whether you have to buy a health insurance policy or not.
Nate, do you want to weigh in on the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause, I should say, in particular? A lot of people are calling in General Welfare Clause. General welfare means the government has the ability and the authority to act in the general welfare, however that's deemed to be seen.
Well, but that's sort of tied to taxation. But let's sort of just deal with first principles here, which is that the modern administrative state, the modern economy, would be seen as completely foreign to the framers of the Constitution, right? And so one argument is to say, well, if you want to give Congress power to regulate in today's economy, you've got to amend the Constitution. Another is to sort of look at the stream of history and say, all right, well, we have developed a interpretation of the Constitution which has allowed play in the joints and allows the government to work and to deal with new problems. Now, you can, you know, this debate has been going on since the Constitution was founded. And then there's a fundamental question, which I think Ilya is posing, which is, well, what are the bounds of federal power? Where do, you know, what powers are reserved to the states as compared to the federal government? And sort of, does the health care bill push the envelope? But realize what, you know, if you go down this path, it's not just, you know, dealing with regulation of wheat that you're talking about. Whether it's the federal drug possession laws, which, you know, prevent people and, you know, could put them in jail for possessing drugs, not even necessarily selling them. Whether you're talking about the late-term abortion ban, right, which is not about regulating commerce. This cuts both ways. That there's all kinds of federal laws preventing killing endangered species like the bald eagle. These are not commercial enterprises, but we've hung on the hook of the Commerce Clause all of these federal laws that, you know, we've come to see as part of the modern administrative state.
Want to come back, Ellie?
Well, I agree that if you reinterpret the Commerce Clause closer to be faithful to its original constitutional meaning, then a lot of different types of federal laws would be put in jeopardy. For example, there was a conviction 2 years ago. We filed a brief to try to get the Supreme Court to look at it, which it didn't. A guy robbed a pizza shop in suburban Cleveland, Ohio, and he wasn't prosecuted by the state authorities for you know, robbery or, you know, anything like that. He was prosecuted by the feds for interference with interstate commerce because the pizza sauce, the wheat, and the mozzarella all came from different states. And that, this sort of thing goes on regularly, whether we're talking about drugs or otherwise. I think that we do need a fundamental rethink of that. But, and this is, I need to emphasize this, the challenge to Obamacare, in particular the individual mandate, does not require overturning any Supreme Court precedent or challenging any existing laws other than the individual mandate.
Why not?
because this is a step beyond. As I've been arguing and as the people who are challenging have said, even accepting Wickard versus Filburn, accepting Raich versus Gonzalez, which is a 2005 case involving medicinal marijuana, so whether it's wheat or weed, you know, there's an outermost boundary, never has, as I've said, the government required someone mm-hmm. to engage in economic right. activity in the guise of regulating interstate commerce.
By the way, Nate, did I hear you correctly a moment ago? There are restrictions on abortion and individual drug possession under federal law that
That's
are
right.
based on the Commerce Clause?
Yes. That's the only, again, what else would they be based on? I mean, that's most federal law that we're familiar with, whether you're talking about the Clean Air Act or Endangered Species Act or, you know, Occupational Safety and Health Act, and so much of it is based on the Commerce Clause. And so, you know, the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act, which was passed, has to be based on the Commerce Clause because there's no clause in the Constitution giving one the ability to, you know, to ban abortions. Again, same with something like the Endangered Species Act. I mean, we tend to think that, you know, banning killing of the bald eagle is not about commerce. It's about, you know, protecting a national symbol, et cetera. But there isn't the protecting the national symbol clause of the Constitution.
On abortion, they could ban murder if they deem it to be murder without resorting to the Commerce Clause, couldn't they?
No. That is yeah. where it has to come out from. I mean, we could spin out some kind of argument that under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment you could ban murder based on that. But basically, most federal laws that federal criminal laws are based on the Commerce Clause. There are some exceptions there, but that's where.
Nate,
I agree with that, and that's because the federal government does not have general police powers like states do. Federal
uh-huh.
government is limited to its no. enumerated powers in the Constitution, and that's why you know, I agree with Nate's analysis of what he just said, that the Endangered Species Clause is a little more complicated because you could argue that some species cross state lines and some don't. Then there is a federalism problem if they don't. Yeah, there's plenty of federal laws that really shouldn't be there. We over-criminalize and over-federalize what we do, and you know, and that's kind of a cross-ideological complaint. Whether it's the Heritage Foundation
yep.
Or the Center for American Progress, they all have complaints about federal overreach and criminal and other types of laws.
All right, it's the Constitution according to the Tea Party, the Constitution according to you, and we'll hear what some of you are calling and writing in with respect to your constitutional questions, as Congress now has to issue constitutional authority statements with every new bill that is proposed, for Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute and Nate Persily from the Columbia University Law School. 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us. Lara on WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, the Tunisia Revolution and the wave of self-immolations in North Africa. Might this be a turning point in Arab democracy? That's coming up tomorrow here on the Brian Lehrer Show. Right now, we continue with our right and left constitutional scholars, Ilya Shapiro from the Libertarian Cato Institute and Nate Persily, professor at the Columbia University Law School. And as promised, it's time for some listener-nominated favorite constitutional passages to get the takes from both our guests. We've been asking you to write in or call in with your favorites. So, Nate, Ilya, meet Amber Pinter of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Amber, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Brian.
And you wrote in with
yes.
Another part of Article 1, Section 8, which contains
yes.
the Commerce Clause. Go ahead.
Well, I chose subsection 15, which is, quote, to provide for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And I chose this because I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas, and this clause spoke to me in the use of the federal government's military force in the integration of Central High School.
Is there a liberal or conservative view on this so long after the integration of the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, at the point of a gun of federal troops, Ilya?
Well, I also commented that this power was not enforced or not used by the Congress or President Jackson in terms of Indian removal in support of the Cherokee Nation in the 1830s, and we also had the Trail of Tears across our state in the 1830s as a result of the lack of using this power to enforce the laws. I just found it interesting. I think it's in the eye of the beholder, and one of your earlier guests referred to the lack of police powers, and I have to disagree with him. We obviously do have the right as a country to enforce martial law using subsection 15.
Yeah, so Ilya from Cato, on this, and to read again from this subsection 15,
yep.
Congress has the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Is it worth noting that many gun rights advocates interpret the Second Amendment as allowing for the formation of militia to create insurrections, you know, or at least to protect against government intrusion?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, that's kind of like the right to revolution, which is we're getting very philosophical and high-minded, you know, extra-constitutional, you know, whether it's warranted, whatnot. But getting back to the concrete question here, the desegregation of Central High School was actually, Nate can correct me, but I believe that's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. That is, the court decided that segregation was in education was unconstitutional. You know, separate is inherently not equal, and so forth. And so Congress was, or the federal government was enforcing the law. It wasn't suppressing an insurrection or an invasion. Indeed, when it does suppress, you know, invasions, Pearl Harbor or what have you, get involved in military actions, that's always in the power to raise armies and the commander-in-chief power under Article 2 and all of that. So the government does enforce its laws, often at the point of a gun. You know, they arrest people and all that. It comes under the necessary and proper clause that the government can do everything that's necessary and proper to fulfill its lawfully enumerated powers. Now, as for the Trail of Tears and the Cherokee Nation, there could have been some unconstitutional behavior going on there, certainly immoral and bad policy and so forth. But I don't think that's the clause that's implicated there. And again, Nate can correct me. And finally, on the police power, that doesn't mean the police as we think of the men in blue. Police power means legislating for the health, safety, welfare, and morals of the population, kind of a broad grant of power that rests with the states but not in the enumerated powers of the federal government.
So let me leave that there and thank Amber for calling in from Fayetteville, Arkansas. We really, really appreciate your participation. And we go to our next Constitution reader, and that's Catherine Dupuy. Catherine, meet our two scholars, Ilya Shapiro and Nate Persily, and tell us about your nomination.
Well, I'm back at the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. I am part Ojibwa Mohawk, and I always have to remember how much of the Constitution speaks to the fact that the Indian peoples were considered foreign nations with the original writers of this document. And unfortunately, in the history of our country since that time, that hasn't always been kept up by the government, by the Congress, and by the courts. In fact, so much still remains in the court because the original treaties have never been followed. And then the second question that I have, which deals with this same clause, is the stuff that's happening today in New York State, but in many other states, about the fact that goods and services and commerce is happening on the Indian lands, and it's not taxable by the state authorities because sales tax is a state issue, not a federal issue, and the only jurisdiction over the Indian peoples on this continent in this country is the federal government. It is not. There is no state jurisdiction over any Indian people.
So, Nate from Columbia University, can you weigh in on any of this?
Well, there's several clauses in the Constitution dealing with Indian tribes. It talks about representation, not including Indians, not taxed at the same place where it talks about other persons, particularly African Americans or slaves being 3/5 of other persons. So that, the original document is very explicit as to who is included and who is excluded, and we have a series of amendments to deal with that and to grant citizenship more broadly, whether on the basis of race and the 14th Amendment, or I should say that the elimination of slavery in the 13th Amendment, and then the protections of the 14th Amendment with privileges and immunities and equal protection of the laws. And so, yes, Indian tribes continue to have a special status because of both the history of treaties and the fact that they are seen in some respects as separate nations, but the original document is very different than what it is as amended once we have the 13th and 14th Amendments.
And maybe one thing to note is that the 14th Amendment, which famously removed the 3/5 clause and granted citizenship to blacks, did not initially do the same for Native Americans. It was only wasn't until the Indian Citizenship Act many years later that that happened. So what do you make of the way in which the Constitution continues to affect our relationship with Indians? Does Cato ever look at this, Ilya?
We do occasionally, and it's difficult because the Indian provisions in the Constitution are an accommodation with pre-constitutional realities. We weren't building on a tabula rasa, on a blank slate. And so we had to accommodate this idea of there being other sovereigns which weren't quite like France and Britain and other countries that the framers were more used to dealing with, or there were set rules and established international law and so forth. So even to this day, it's somewhat problematic that, as you said, the Native Americans have the right to vote in U.S. elections, but then they're also a sovereign. So how can you have these conflicting sovereignties? And it's a very tricky and complicated issue from a matter of first principles or from constitutional law. And I'm not sure the right balance has been struck, given that so much of Indian law disputes these days have to do exactly with taxation of gaming and so forth, and not the types of concerns that the Native Americans had back in the day when they were first interacting with the colonialists and the new country.
All right, we're talking about the Tea Party's favorite clauses of the Constitution and yours. And next on the line with us is David, who wants to bring up Article 6. Hi, David.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, Article 6 is most relevant to me because I'm an atheist, but I'd like to point out that I think what it does is imply that the Constitution was bringing together this country on a set of common principles, common values, and the founders deliberately wanted to avoid having religion interfere with that set of common values, if that makes sense.
Nate?
Well, the provision that the caller is referring to says that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. That's the less famous religion clause in the First Amendment, which provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And so that the First Amendment, which most people focus on, right, was a revolution in many ways because of its prohibition both of government involvement, or federal at least, involvement in establishing religion, but also the protection of people's ability to freely exercise their religion. So it was, there's a reason that amendment comes first.
And let's take one more call. Anne in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I hear discussions about the constitutionality of various issues, I have a concern that's on a more basic level, which is, while it is a wonderful and admirable thing to have our country based on the Constitution, I feel as if we should remember that the Constitution was not handed down by God at the beginning of the world. It was created by fallible men and may need to be corrected by fallible men. To me, the question should not be whether it is constitutional, but is it obviously best for the health and safety and et cetera of the people? And what supports me in this view is the ridiculous necessity to hang crimes like murder and robbery on the Interstate Commerce Clause. Well, that's clearly a ridiculous situation. The Constitution, if it needs to be invoked, it should be taking care of us in the ways that we need to be taken care of, And if it has to be changed, so be it. I just don't feel as if it should be treated as if it is carved in stone and has been forever.
Right. Of course, changing the Constitution, amending the Constitution, is a much more complicated process that involves a large majority of the states and a large majority of both houses of Congress than passing a simple federal law. But why don't you each give us a last thought on that as kind of an overarching principle? I think we could probably hear from a lot of people in our area who would say the same thing as Ann in Greenwich. Nate Persily.
Well, again, starting from first principles, if we do go with the vision of the Constitution that was realized at the time of the framing, then things like the right to vote, racial equality, women's equality, and a whole host of other protections that we have come to assume are sort of part of the fabric of the country go away. Now, there is a sort of purist argument that, well, if you want those protections, then you need to amend the Constitution. But that train has left the station. And to sort of go back and to try and recreate a time which may never even really have existed and in which, you know, sort of for a country that was very different than our own is going to be extremely difficult, if not completely impossible.
And a last word, Ilya Shapiro.
Well, we have to remember why we care about the Constitution. That's because that's where the government gets its legitimate use of power. Without the Constitution, it's just a lot of people, you know, the majority ganging up with guns. So if we care about the Constitution in that way, then we should follow the amendment procedures when we want to change it. And I agree with Nate that, you know, women's rights and the right to vote, regardless of race and all of those things, are good things. And indeed, there were constitutional amendments to get those through. The post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments, perfected the Constitution in the terms of many scholars, because the original framers had to make this compromise with slavery. It wasn't until after the Civil War that we could guarantee civil rights against state violation, not just federal. So those are good things. But as we discussed before, during the New Deal, the Supreme Court started going off the tracks and amending the Constitution in effect without having a constitutional amendment, at the strong behest of the Roosevelt administration, who would send up notes to Congress, for example, saying, don't let any constitutional qualms prevent you from voting from this very good legislation. And that's the wrong way to go about doing things. Now, I'm a constitutional guy. I'm not a healthcare policy expert or an economic policy expert. So if we want to do something that's unconstitutional, you know, have that debate about whether we should amend the Constitution in that way, and then my constitutional arguments fall away, and it's just a matter of a political debate.
Well, we will see if the Roberts Court takes up that challenge to roll back constitutional interpretation to pre-FDR times, and we will see what the new Congress does, as the majority in the House has now required a constitutional authority statement alongside any new bill. And we thank Ilya Shapiro from the Libertarian Cato Institute. We thank Nate Persily, professor of law at Columbia University, for fielding questions from our listeners on their favorite passages in the Constitution, as well as talking about what's being debated in Washington right now. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for participating. And again, we have a thoroughly unscientific constitutional poll question on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. You don't have to be a Supreme Court justice to have an opinion. The question is, do you think it's constitutional for the federal government to require individuals to buy health insurance? Answer yes or no at itsafreecountry.org. You can also hang around and join the conversation about that. But do you think it's constitutional for the federal government to require individuals to buy health insurance? Answer yes or no in our thoroughly unscientific constitutional poll at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer, WNYC, more in a minute.